Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 7th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, Mary Scott Boria continues her study of social justice, transforming a vision. Today's topic is entitled Racial Reconciliation, a Spiritual Journey, a Spiritual Dialogue. This is session SBM 2000-9. Let's listen in.
45 minutes to an hour. So for those of you that weren't here yesterday, the video that we're watching is called The Way Home. And it is a group of different ethnic groups of women speaking about the impact of race on their lives. And so they're all grouped by specific ethnic groups. And so those groups are Indian, Native American, Latina, African American, European American, Asian, Arab, Jewish, and multiracial. I think I've gotten them all. And I want you to listen in particular. We talked a lot yesterday about internalization and the socializing messages that we in this country get about people of color and about being white and what that does to us and how that shapes who we are and how that shapes how we act in the world. And so these groups of women kind of talk about their own unique experience around that. And I think they talk about stories, about identity, about history, about socialization, and even about loss and what that means. And so I'm going to stay.
You know, talk about it anymore.
Doily and white lace and my black grandmother's there's plastic on the seat.
Yeah, just rewind this one.
Have a good morning.
Reaction that I have, and one that puts me in a place of not knowing what to do. Both sides of my family are so different. My white grandmother, everything was very doily and white lace, and my black grandmother's side, there's plastic on the seats and.
Are you that?
I wanted to be white. I wanted to be so white, and I started to really straighten my hair and change the way that I spoke, and everything from my mother didn't understand that I'd never washed my own hair, that it had always been done by black women. And I said to her, well, now that I'm living with you, who's going to do my hair? And she said, well, do your own hair. And I just remember just shaking and just thinking, you know, I can't just do my own hair. And looking in the Oakland phone book, just hoping to find under beauty products a black face or a name that would say Mr. Washington or, you know, Jerry Salon or Maurice's Style House or just something, right? I'll do whatever I need to do to get my hair done. And just realizing all the differences and having people say, oh, you're adopted. I didn't know you were adopted. I'd say, no, this is my mother. This is my mother. And realizing that I could never be white. I wanted to have like this little happy Brady Bunch kind of life because I didn't. And eventually I came to terms with the fact that I'm never going to be white. And you know, like you did, I'm never going to be white. And I just need to accept that. I never longed to be white. There weren't any white people in my life that loved me, that nurtured me, that cared about me. And after a while, I became resentful that they were absent. You know, I didn't want my mother to show up for anything. I was very ashamed. So when I was with my father is where I found comfort and where I had family connections.
Okay.
American. And it was the more you can look like, you know, the American, you know, lighter skin, certain features, get rid of the accent, don't learn Spanish, listen to rock and roll instead of, you know, salsa. So everything was yanked away.
We have this group of young Tagalog kids. We were 10, 11, 12, and we're all boat people. And we so afraid that we will lose our culture, that we stay together all the time. And we don't want to assimilate.
Was that conscious though? Did you talk about it in the group?
It was our choice that we went to Chinese school. And then we always want to be like a big sister in the Chinese school. We would tell the little kid, don't you ever lose Chinese language. You know, you have to like learn who's the president of China and things like that. And then we know people that in the middle school who become ABC, which is American born Chinese. But that's the group that we don't want to be. So it's really funny, in the cafeteria we have two sides. And it seems like we created this enemy group, and they will always speak English, and then we will like make fun of them. When I went to college, I hang around Caucasian friends. Then I lost that group of people.
You're the ABC now?
No. Mm-hmm. Oh no, because I'm not born here. And I'm aware, and ABC is a label. I also feel that when I say ABC, as looking down on them, and as like making a joke, and as like, huh, you are Chinese, but you don't know Chinese. You know, like, I am a bingo, I read that Chinese. You know, I say that term with all these feelings behind it. And they can feel it too. I mean, I meet people, I'm like, huh, ABC. They say God, you know, a lot of things behind that three letter.
Well, that's really helpful because now I know how you look at me. I've always wondered, see, it's always been important for me to guess what it was like to be you.
There have been times where I got away from being Asian, classifying myself as an Asian, but not like that. Okay. I remember that growing up and just, you know, not asking my mom to wear a sari when she'd take me to school. She used to wear pants to work, but she'd wear saris when she came home and when we went out in the evenings. And that was part of her assimilation, just being really tired of having everyone ask why you wear the red dot, what does the bindi mean, what does it mean to wear a sari. And in some ways it took away from her ability to be a good teacher. And yet it was something when she came home, she could be that whole person she was and felt most comfortable as.
I remember going for my first job interview, you know, and removing my bindi, wearing my nice tailored suit, and looking at the mirror, I said, oh my God, you know, this is what my parents wanted me to be. I have to just disrobe everything I know about Sri Lankan and being Asian. And I'm still learning to unlearn what I had loaded myself with in wanting to be so prim. I was trying to live up to the model minority myth. Mm-hmm. And so of course you have 4-point, you know, GPAs. But there's a price to pay for it. Yes, I have this great exterior shell in my life, but all it takes is one crack, and the inside is nothing.
I was so into assimilating into American culture and learning the school system, the culture, and how to speak without the accent, and how to act politely, and how to forego the criticisms and the looks, because I don't want to make them angry at me. I don't want them to not like me because I'm different and I can't stand up for my difference. It frightens me now to think about it because I've never actually looked back and seen how much I've changed and being very confused about who I am and who I've become. the people I go to for help are white. How do I tell them my entire story of where I came from, who I am, and feel that they will accept me?
Over 2 years, and so I find it fairly safe to say that I'm Indian. What I find the most difficult is going back to India or being judged by Indians as not being Indian enough. It's scarier sort of to go home and to find out that you don't really belong or you're not accepted there.
Or what I'll get a lot, gosh, you're so Indian, we're not even like this in India. Yeah. Why do you
deal with?
For me, the whole question of, you know, what is really Indian, or in my case, what is really Indonesian, and, you know, leaving one's country, I mean, for me, I never left because I was never there, you know, and so my reference point for what is Indonesian has been growing up, my parents. And, you know, when we're in Indonesia and people can't understand us because they speak Indonesian of 25 years ago, then I realized, oh, they're not Indonesian either, you know? Now what do I do? Then I think, oh dear, you know, the last 3 decades, what have I been mimicking, you know, or trying to, you know, emulate? And then what, of course, have I chosen not to emulate, and how does this figure into it? You know, the truth is that I will never feel comfortable there, will never feel entirely accepted there, and nor will I hear it. And that is why I've always asked the question of, you know, who can I find who is most like me?
I kind of needed some reflection. I almost feel like I'm grieving for all that time of feeling so alone and not, I mean, really not being able to relate to anybody. I mean, nobody really. And always feeling like I was just not quite right, you know, just wasn't quite right.
I really felt, you know, really ashamed growing up, and I think what really changed that is my mom introducing me to a Filipino community that was like on the other side of town, not where we lived. We'd like drive 45 minutes to be around brown people. And I always felt that my mother was that bridge. She would say, this is my daughter Lisa, and I'm like, oh, okay, she must be brown, and she must be Filipino, she's down, da da da. But when I went to college and didn't have that mom to show me to the community, I was lost. I was very lost. I went to a lot of the Filipino clubs, and they were like, the Latin groups are down the hall, you know, the black groups over there. And I'm like, but no, I'm you guys. I'm here. This is my people. And they would not accept me. And I think in college, the group that did accept me was the African American community. And that is where I felt the most love and felt the most accepted.
The white folks next door were really pissed off that they had these Japanese people moving in next to them. But the kids at Japanese school, where we had to go every Saturday, would fight with us every recess because we were Hapa, half-breeds. They didn't like white people. So here I am with both sides of my family, none of them liking us. And very quickly, I think each of us sort of created some identity that wasn't Asian or white. And until college, when I tried to join the Asian Students Union and I couldn't get in because it wasn't Asian enough, so I ended up with the Filipinos at the East Indians. No, I didn't get into the Asian Students Union because you had to be Japanese or Chinese or Asians. And they argued with me and said, you are not Asian because your father is not Asian, and your father has to be Asian for you to be Asian. What do you mean? I'm not, you know, I eat with chopsticks. You know, what kind of test do I have? anymore. And all of a sudden, I started getting all these assignments. I'm a journalist to write about the Mission District. It's like, well, let's get her. She's Mexican. She knows what they're talking about. So, you know, it's kind of, I know. So it's like your race becomes your face. And whatever my face was, and I remember staring in the mirror as a child going, well, what do I look like? I still don't have a sense of what I look like. I have become a Latina, basically.
For people who are monoracial, they're dealing with the outside. But when you're biracial, the power struggle within of how do you come to terms with the way things are socially structured and how we've been socialized into these roles or forced into these places where we don't want to be, that's not comfortable for us. You know, I grew up in a time where I had to choose. It wasn't an option. It wasn't like, I'm mixed. Like Isabel says, you know, I'm mixed and I'm proud.
I remember filling out the application for Urban and they said, you know, race, check one. And I was like, I can't check one. You know, and I've always checked other. And it was like, I'm an other now. I don't have a name. I'm an other.
You know, actually there was a law. The law of Hybel descent in the 1600s. And the law said that if you had one drop of black blood, you were black. And so there is a historical precedence that form this ideology that people still live by. And so, just so that you know that where that came from, and it was based on economics, it is a shifting paradigm for people to think differently about not having to choose one or the other.
I'm glad you brought that up because I also think it's a hard thing to let go of. I'll say, well, I'm half white, but I identify as African American, and part of that has to be with my sense of almost political alignment with being African American, because when I look at myself and society looks at me, I'm black. It doesn't. No one looks at me and says, "My better mother's white." I said, I can't be anything but black. That is provided by being unidentifiable.
And what is it?
What is it? You get to be whatever you want to be.
I don't know that you get to be whatever you want to be because there's still the cultural things coming from behind you of what you are and the societal things coming at you from the front of what you're allowed to be.
My experience is definitely I get to be what I want to be because if I say I'm Arab that's and of color, it's just really so irrelevant because I'm, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think in those terms. So when people really address that issue, to me, I'm thinking, okay, well, I'll play a game for a while, but in the end, I know what I'm doing. But I don't feel pressed because actually people like the way my color, they like my hair. I'm a good person. I'm a good human being. Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't matter to them if I'm green, purple, or red. I don't have a total carefree life, but the doors are not closed in my face because I have the color of skin that I do. You know, that's what I want to also speak to. It's not, there is light in the shadow, but we're talking also about the light in the shadow, not just the shadow.
Yeah.
And I want to address the light because I'm living in the light. That's what I'm saying. And it's like I see the issue and I see the problem and I also see the solutions and I see the hope and I see the light. And I want to talk about the light, God damn it.
I think the life that you're speaking of isn't a non-racist life. It's a life where you're passing as the more dominant culture. I think a lot of that is why we're grouped in to the white category, because we can pass.
I understand you say not a lot of doors have been closed in your face. It's not about doors being closed in my face either. It's about having to walk into an institution and having to explain why I do the things I do. It's having to walk through a campus and having to explain why I look the way, dress the way, talk the way I do. That's what it's about. It's having to explain why I do what I do, why my family is the way that it is. That's the type of racism I'm talking about. That's where I'm different. That's where I am not white. I am colored.
there is also a cultural or a group experience. A man as dark as the man to whom I'm married may, on a personal level, you know, if he's not got his eyes open looking around him, say, my life is free of this stuff. I'm moving freely in the world because my white friends and my own friends love me, and I'm getting on very well. But if he moves outside of that context, that kind of cocoon of friends, the reality is pretty brutal, you know. And on an ongoing basis, I will act as a spy, you know. I will go down and he will go down. The car is not accepted for air conditioning repair. I will go down. It will be taken in the same day. He will go down to do a bank transaction. Someone will stop him. I will go down. The transaction will be carried out. And obviously, then we have to take action in order to protest that. And it becomes a way in which you live in the world, that these things on a cultural and a social level become part of your very life.
I told you all a story about up until 10 or 15 years ago when people would say, you know, Penny, you don't look Jewish. And I'd say, thank you. I mean, and the fact that it's only been recently that I remembered that story. I was raised as white, and it's white as central, and Jewish was a part of that. I grew up not only celebrating Passover and Hanukkah, but celebrating Christmas and Easter, because my folks, who had very strong Jewish identities, wanted me to be an American. They wanted me to fit in.
I feel it almost on the exact opposite of how you feel it. It's like, I didn't feel deprived of my culture, even though I'm Ashkenazi, I didn't feel that. And I grew up with a lot of Jewishness, and I wasn't taught to be an American. My parents didn't want us to fit in. They wanted us to retain our culture. And I don't have the association with whiteness that you do. When I was growing up, you know, it was the Lower East Side. There were all these Orthodox Jewish men. They'd be on the street and dancing and singing and Simchat Torah, and they'd have the Torah rolling out through the street, and they'd, you know. And my father would go down to get bagels, you know, and like 3 or 4 hours later, he'd come back home, you know. And it was just like he had talked to every single person on the street. And there was just love. We did folk dancing on Wednesday night and square dancing on Friday night. And there was just this, it was rich. You know, it was rich.
I just longed for that. It's easy to say now, but I feel like I would trade all the fucking privilege for that sense of belonging and that sense of connection. So I'm just really looking at what part of my voice have I been holding back, you know, or how do I reclaim that? And just when you were just saying that, I just felt this terror, like, oh my God. It's like, I mean, I can feel myself shaking when I, you know, when I think about my assimilation and think about, like, my New York Jewish relatives, you know. And it was like this disgust. That was the anti-Semitism. That was the internalized stuff. And I said, it felt like worms crawling inside my body.
Taught to feel disgusted about ourselves, and
And it's not your fault, Penny, that you ever were made to feel that.
I thought I was the only one that felt it. I thought it was me.
Girl!
We want to accept the power that we have, the beauty of being
African, of being Cubana, of being bilingual, of being beautiful. We want to accept that power, and yet we have these images around, or lack of images around us. And the only images around us are those that deny who we are. Which even people who are designated as white are in some sense supposed to match up to. And if you don't, and in England, believe me, that it's much more homogenous, and if you are endowed with a different type of, any different type of feature, automatically that will gain ridicule.
When we don't look like that standard of beauty, what happens to us?
My mom gave me the complex about my nose, and it was reinforced by all of society, so she didn't need to say much. So when I was 6 years old, I said, Mommy, am I pretty? And she said, no, because I'm not blonde, I don't have blue eyes, and I don't have a ski slope nose, and especially my nose bugged the shit out of me, because do you know how much shit is out there about the Jewish nose? How much, like, mockery? And I was thinking, you know, I started touching my nose recently and saying, you poor thing.
Child can look at me and say, well, I think rocks are they're dirty, stinky, and, you know, she looked at me and told me that. And this was my elder.
That's fine.
Oh, we had to go in the next room and have a talk. Oh, we yelled and screamed, and I know people were standing at the door. We were in there for an hour, but when we came up, she had my respect and I had hers, and we had a totally different rapport.
It's total disrespect
for your choice.
Yeah.
For what you choose.
And I experienced that. I wore locks for 8 or 9 years, and my mom, everybody in my family just laughed at me and talked about me and put me down, and it was an area of unbelief how someone could just hate you because of your hair.
That comes from a devaluation of the texture of I am, and that goes back to slavery. You know, and not being able to comb your hair, you know, or your folks pinching your nose so you would look, you know, as European as possible, so you wouldn't look so African.
Black women are seen as either mammies or Jezebels.
Now, I have had a tendency to mythologize people of color.
Me, as biracial people, are viewed, especially women, as exotic.
It's okay to be exotic and different.
Mountain woman, connected to the earth, and so I want what she's got. I'm just a woman.
You're exotic, you're easy, you're sexy, you're kinky, you're, and I'm like, you know.
I'm getting angry right now because when they make me into a goddess, damn it, I don't have feelings. I can't be the person that sits, looks at that camera right now and has feelings about stuff that's happened to me in my life because I'm a goddess, I'm big, I'm an Amazon, I'm exotic, and it's not, it marginalizes me, it takes the humanness out of me. I am a damn human being. The people we were most dependent on taught us to hate the color of our skin,
right,
to be ashamed of how it looked.
When I was born, my mother, you know, said, this can't be my child, because I was, as you can imagine, quite, you know, dark and hairy. She used to tell this as sort of, you know, something funny. And the way she decided to survive Jewish oppression was basically to say that I'm not Jewish, she said, but my children are Jewish. You know, the whole question of being dark, you know, and having a dark child was very dangerous. She felt it was a threat to her survival.
All my life, I was brought up to look as much like a white woman as possible. You straighten your hair, you stay light. I think I shared with all of you about my grandmother making me wear the hats, you know, these big hats, because Lord help us, I should get any darker if I was out in the sun.
when I come in with a tan or come back from a vacation or something, she always says to her friends, she really is the lightest one.
Lighter is better. So in African American culture, I've been lifted up. I've been special. I've been, I got good hair. I have light skin. I have all of those attributes. And sometimes it makes me sick.
Mm-hmm. I'm the only one in the group that addresses us Afro-Cuban, and I guess it is very painful for me. I look at all your faces and I see the love and the support that you have, but that's not always what I've gotten from my Latino friends, because they see me as black first. You know, it was the Latino close friends and best friends who told me you can't dance in my 15 because your partner is too dark. You can come because you're lighter. And it's that same Latino community that, you know, got me ready to go to face the world, already knowing that I was different and I wasn't always going to be accepted.
It isn't easy because we get those messages of, you know, blacks, you don't go out with a black. My best friend in high school was a black transvestite. And we had the best times together. But you think I would ever tell my family who I was hanging with? No way. And yet, when they did find out that we were walking home from school together, as soon as I walked in the door, I got battered physically and verbally. My brother was ready to leave the house. My father went into a whole tirade of stories about the black men he worked with and how they treated women. And I thought to myself, I can't believe what I'm hearing in this house. How can you claim to be Christian and talk this way? How can you, have somebody my color and talk this way? You're a dark person. How can you talk that way? I couldn't understand it. It was beyond me.
You know, my black sisters are my sisters just as much as my Latino sisters are. And I experience a lot of pain with not being able to openly express that at home. Not being able to feel like they would be fully accepted in the way my love for them would not be fully accepted. You know, even though I know that my parents would never, ever in their life say they're not welcome here, because my friends always were, but again, there's that underlying feeling of, well, they're different.
They're not Latinos.
Yeah.
If I say I'm Iraqi, my skin comes no question. There are white Iraqis, there are dark Iraqis. If I say I'm a Jew, you're white. The same skin.
My daughter, who's 15, I mean, I just learned this like a month ago from her, that when she goes into a store, usually, she's followed around because people suspect she's going to steal something. And she said, as matter-of-factly as anything else, and I said, what? Why didn't you tell me? She said, well, you know, I mean, to her, that's as normal as it never happening to me is normal. We all live in the same house, and we all walk out the same door, and they go to a whole different world, and I hardly ever think about that. And there's only so close I can get to that.
I have a white half-sister who's older than me. She has no clue as to how her own siblings live. My youngest child is fairly dark. My sister's child is blonde-haired and blue eyes. She is able to adapt much more to the white world and feels comfortable there and we have the same parents as, similar genetics, everything, but just because of all of these colored values, we will never have the same experiences in life.
Betty, how did you feel being raised in the South, having to go to covered bathrooms or go into the... Did you experience stuff like that?
Well, during that time, everything to its time, but I didn't feel bad because that's where it was. I couldn't change it, so I accepted it.
So
until it got better.
And you felt bad about it, but you just accepted it as it...
Well, I had to. What could I do? Anything has changed, and I'm grateful for it. You know, I see any good, I see nothing bad. I don't have no hard feeling at all. The same God brought me will carry me right now.
from house to house and be able to see this big picture of God being white.
They lynched us under the name of the justify their right to kill if they say, I'm doing this in the name of God.
How many of us are aware of the brown bag rule that was prevalent in a lot of the churches in the South? The brown bag rule is if there was a brown bag hanging by some of the doors of churches, if you tried to go into that church and you were darker than that brown bag, you could not get in. And there was also a comb that was hanging by some of the churches. If you pick up the comb and it couldn't go through your hair, you could not go into that church. Now that's oppressive stuff. Some churches have perpetuated that type of thing.
Use that spiritual structure. Why do you use religion to perpetuate those kinds of things? Why would you bring that into a house of God? My sister had started going to a church, and she said, you really have to come to church, because the whole family were all going to church for Easter, and we had fun. And I was like, I want to go to church. You know, and I don't want to go to church because I know that there's going to be some homophobic feelings in there. I don't want to deal with it. And I totally own up to the fact that I anticipated that, and I put that out there without knowing what was going to happen. You know, I was defiant about that. I was defensive about that happening. And my sister said, oh, please, come on. Just, you know, nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen. So I was like, you know what? That's true. I don't know anything's going to happen. Get to church. Preacher starts talking about gay folks. Starts talking about, you know, fad this and, you know, be a real man that and you know, that manly women this. And everybody in the church started laughing, including my family. Including my family. And when I mentioned it later at brunch to my family, they said, oh, please, Debbie. They weren't talking about, you know, you should be used to that by now. That should be okay. As a heterosexual, I carry a lot of stuff. You know, I have a picture of my sister there on this table. I lost my sister. You know, and I lost my sister because she had a relationship with another woman, and it was like I couldn't even stand to undress in front of my sister thinking that it was something she was going to do to me. This is my sister. This was my sister. You know, I mean, but I had no way being socialized in this world, I had no way to relate to my sister who had a relationship with another woman. Do you understand? There's something really sick about that. I mean, really, there's something really sick about that. I can relate to all these women who have relationships with men, but I can't relate to my sister because she had a relationship with a woman, and I'm a woman too.
The thing that has always astounded me is that we can judge gay and lesbian people and in so doing oppress them in the same way that we have been oppressed.
It's this taste in my mouth for oppression, for making someone feel like they're not a part of the planet just because of what's in your head.
The first boy that I ever kissed was a black boy. And I remember I was so excited to go home and tell my mom that I kissed this boy and absolutely adored him, you know. And my mom was very accepting of it, but at the same time I could hear her apologizing for it when she would speak about it to other people. You know, well, he's a really nice young man. He plays basketball. And, you know, even though my mom was trying to get away from that whole way of thinking and looking at things, I don't think she could help it. It was unconscious.
It was Feet Week, 1967, and this white sailor came up and said, hey, pretty white girl, too bad she's with a nigger. And he had two ice creams and he said, well, I mean it, if you need me, I'm over there. And my boyfriend at the time said, you're not getting over there, and the ice creams flew, and a fight, and then we heard the police sirens. And I stood there with this invisible veil of symbolic and cultural protection and said, stand your ground. You did nothing wrong. At which point he said, whoa, do you have a lot to learn about the way things are?
If I marry a Vietnamese man, I can be kicked out of the family.
remember at my prom, I wanted to go to the prom with a Vietnamese man, and my brother said, I would rather you go with a black man. And then I ended up going to prom with my brother. But that's that deep. So
it's like the joke I told about my husband being named Soon He, and how the black bottom introduced him to. They were going, say it again. They couldn't say it, and I just say, oh come on, Negro. And the us, we got named Shaniqua, Shanaqua, and you can't say Soon He. You can't look at a Korean person and adjust so that his name sounds bizarre.
They stop listening.
Yeah, and I go, you stop looking, you stop listening. I confront the black folks that I'm connected to, and I say, you can't say my husband's name. What is the problem? You know, I realize him being Korean is the problem.
Being with someone for over 2 years now who's Chinese, you know, someone in my family saying, well, does he even look like Latino? You know, does he even sound Latino? You know, help us out here, Maya. So still that ongoing thing.
Yeah.
And although I know they don't mean to hurt me, it hurts me, you know? It hurts me to hear things like that.
Any woman I've been close to, been lovers with, and been Ashkenazi, part of that is I can't find any so far. But also, I mean, it would feel incestuous to me. I don't really even want to date a Sephardi woman. Now, is that not fucked up? Of course it's fucked up. I don't want to date a Sephardi woman. I'm attracted to Ashkenazi women. And what does that say, then? I mean, all this pride I have about being a Sephardi woman, but at night, when things are quiet, I don't want somebody making me burekas. I want somebody making me matzo ball soup. Most of those Ashkenazi women have also been middle to upper middle class. So I don't know what it is or where it comes from, but certainly it's some kind of oppression that I've internalized. I think this country has so much wrong with it, but I'm very grateful to it, because I don't know what I would do as a Sephardi lesbian in Turkey. But I suspect I would not have a happy life.
I'm talking to my nephew, and he's 24, 25 years old, and he's telling me all the stories about his girlfriends, and I feel like we're really bonding. Then he says something that lets me know that all these women are white. And my heart broke. It was like I was totally rejected. And then the other part of me was like, be rational about this. You know, he has his choice. Let's be more involved in the way you look at this. He just likes them better. And what comes up is no. I've got to try to have straight hair and to have that body that's all skinny and straight or whatever and doesn't get out of control. You know, and once you've done all that, then the man that you've done all that for turns and chooses a white woman, the real thing, or what, you know, and this is where the pain, there's been a lot of pain for me, a lot of pain for me.
My experience is on the other side of your nephew's, because for 10 years I was married to a white man, and you guys didn't know that when I was doing all this stuff, and it takes a while. The relationship ended maybe about 3 years ago now, maybe 4 years ago. And it ended when I realized, I woke up and I realized that I'm with this white man because I want privilege. You know, the white man has a certain amount of privilege, and he can open this door for me and I can get this privilege with that. But I was with him for 10 years, and it took me 10 years to realize that he gave up that privilege when he decided to be with me, basically. I'm a big woman having a big body, big feet, you know, big lips, all this stuff. It all became okay when the white man validated it. And when I realized that I was getting this validation from this white person, and that I was ignoring, you know, anything that was coming from brothers, that was another piece I had to look at. That's when I started looking at and dealing with internalized racism.
There was a white man that I was dating, and he actually goes, I love you so much. He goes, but God, he goes, I don't, he goes, our children, they wouldn't look like me. I said, are you crazy? They wouldn't look like you. And then he looked at him and I said, oh, I get it. They might be brown. And I said, you're so invested in your whiteness. White skin is something so important that you wouldn't be able to recognize in your own children that they are you and that they look like you. And
I don't know, it's so common to hear people say, I don't see color. But it's just the opposite of that. That's all they see is color.
There has to be a leap in consciousness, I think, on white people's parts to go, you know what, I can connect physically with a person of color and see myself in them, and really see myself in them, not just like go, oh yeah, well we're just the same, I go, no, you don't really think we're the same, because you can't see yourself in me, you just can't.
I've gone through my life, my 50 years of reacting to white people, and that's very oppressive, and that's very marginalizing, and that's all that stuff. And so my recovery now is, how can I walk through this world not in reaction to them, but walk into this world because I've developed my own set, my own community, and I'm proud about all that I am. I think when we look into our personal stories, I think that's when the chains are broken of this stuff. You know, when we start doing the mending or the healing from inside.
Your imagination. Yeah.
But it was important for me to hear. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, we looked down at you, we thought you were shit, whatever. But now, you know, we see you. Mm-hmm. And we're here.
There is a choice I can make now for the privileges I have, about the resources that I have, whatever they are. It's how I choose to use each one of them each day to untangle those interlocking, thick, yucky webs of racism, classism, sexism, homophobia, all those interlocking, systemic, it's institutionalized, oppressive forces. It's choice by meticulous choice.
For me, it's been about going into the belly of the whale, and it's not about, you know, this, like, New Age transcendence thing where you sort of fly above it and put what I call metaphysical band-aids on things. For me, it's been about swimming through the slog, you know, and then it becomes, for me, about soul reclamation. And I want to continue to ask to be willing to be the bad example. To look real, not good.
Well, my path is really about compassion, about opening the heart, about taking risks, telling the truth, and showing by example. And being really gentle on ourselves and others.
I want to be real conscious about the perpetuation sometimes of tradition. And what people talk about when they talk about family values sometimes, because some of that stuff is very repressive, it's very patriarchal, it's very capitalistic, you know, it's very homophobic. That stuff needs to be dismantled and critiqued.
And we see all the stuff that's affecting us as such rigid, you know, it can't change, it's monolithic, it's oppressive and so on. But we make this stuff. It's not static. We can change it. We can resist and we can confront. It's up to us, warrior women. Multiply.
I am a product of what you are all saying, and it's working. I think I am speaking for the youth and saying that there's this feeling that we are progressing. I'm always going to experience the oppression, but I will not allow it to tear me down. I will not allow it. And whether it comes from a place of rage or whether it comes from a place of hope, it's gonna happen for me, and it's gonna happen for my children.
It was done by a Chinese filmmaker in California. His group is called Stir Fry Productions. Oh, and I can't think of it, but it's a very powerful video that actually he uses. He does a tremendous amount of anti-racism work around the country, and he uses it. His mother was killed by an African-American. And so for him, it just raised lots of issues. And, you know, here he is, a person of color who's struggling, and this is the situation that he's confronted with, and he has to sort it out. And he has to sort it out based upon sort of this paradigm of whiteness. And so it's real. I wish I could think of the name of it, but it just escapes me. But it was a group of men sitting around.
The answer is yes. They would say the same thing.
They would say the same thing.
Because I find that when I listen to this, the words used and so forth that the women use, men don't talk that way, in that manner. You know, maybe it's a word order or selection or something.
My husband's Japanese, and when we go to sporting events, every time he carries the backpack, he gets searched. Literally, this happens. And so he doesn't carry it anymore. I carry it.
Sure.
And, so that was my solution, just to carry it. But I can't even know what that feels like to him.
I don't know about, I don't want to say. I've lived all this. I mean, I did this 25 years ago, and I feel pretty whole right now. But what they were saying is exactly what I experienced growing up in the Bay Area. I'm just thankful I was lucky enough to grow up there and be whole today, because I see a lot of people going through this in other places. And maybe the women use different words, but the feelings are all the same. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know about that blue eyes, brown eyes
experiment.
Yeah, I saw that recently, and I remember when it was first done. We saw it on television. And as a follow-up on that, they also had the black fella and the white fella doing different things, like buying a car, buy some things, right? And
Have you been to the Crossroads training?
No, but our women of the OCA and our Synod have done, we've been doing anyway, so I think it's wonderful.
Those are the videos that we use.
I understand. I know the fascia. Mm-hmm. But we haven't actually looked at them there. And also, I've spent time in Thailand, and you know, the same situation is true in every country. There's always some second-class group. Mm-hmm. In Thailand, it was the Chinese immigrants. Well, who's running the country now? Mm-hmm. Chinese thought. And the tribal groups in the north, in the mountainous area, they were always considered second-class citizens. It's a little better now. This country is finally realizing that these people have something to offer. And tourism, of course, has helped them a lot. But this is like human nature, and I've always been puzzled by the Israelis or the Palestinians. Here, these people have been suffering for centuries, and yet they're doing the very same thing to the Palestinians. Having been there and visited, I know. The stories of the Palestinians.
You raise an interesting point, because you said a couple things. You said, you know, here's, you know, there's a big piece of this that's human nature. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the point of look at how it flips.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that one of my colleagues that I work with says, and he's a white man, is that what racism tells this video, for those of you that weren't here yesterday, you missed the dialogue in the White Council. So you didn't see a lot of that in this piece of this part of the video, but there was a lot of dialogue among white women in this group. But the way racism operates in this country and the history of its institutionalization is that there is this deep fear that with racism, I gain, and with the end of racism, I lose. And that's
true.
The power that keeps it in place.
That's power.
And there are all these examples around the world. If we flip it around, what do I lose?
I'll lose. It's paranoia. I'm going to lose.
I grew up in Chicago in a neighborhood that was part Jewish and part Christian, and I have Jewish girlfriends and Christian girlfriends, and our high school dealt with it by having the Christmas program, half Hanukkah and half Christmas. But when I was about 8, I started to take piano lessons, and I learned to play Christmas Carol, and I wanted my grandmother to sing. And she said, I don't know those songs, I'm Jewish. I've never been
never
told.
Never knew that.
Oh. Never been told.
Jeez.
And I was, so then I sort of tried to discover that part of me. Mm-hmm. And she married a Southern Baptist whose family spent their whole life trying to convert grandma. And the more they tried, the more Jewish she became. And
she's done that recently, I remember too.
She died in a Jewish old people's home. Oh. But at any rate, it was very interesting to see how that transpired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking of, oh, excuse me. You all know how old I am.
No.
No. No.
Tell us.
I said 100. Well, anyway, when I grew up in a tiny town in southwest Iowa that was so Swedish that if you weren't a Swede, you were a
nobody.
And you weren't even allowed to date a Catholic or whatever. You know, it was so prejudiced. But I had no idea that it was like that, except we were called the dumb Swedes. And you know, all the other athletic teams and so on, contests that you had, it was dumb Swedes. That was where our embarrassment was. You know, we were. Then where I am at the college, which is Augustana College in Rock Island, I am so proud of that school because our president, who lived to be 102 and I worked for him, you know, we were all Petersons and Swansons and Johnsons. He went there when I did. Now you look at the list who's there and there's no comparison. You think, there aren't even any of them here anymore. It's not that bad, but our president was so ecumenical that he said anybody's allowed to come here. Well, the Catholics were forbidden by the church to come, but the Jewish people in the community came because they felt they were getting in on knowing the story. And so he was so special to the Jewish community that they made him an honorary rabbi. When they were at his funeral, you would see how supportive they have been of that college because of this president. Well, I think the hopeful thing is that started with all their exchange quarters, semesters in every area of the country. So we have the Asian quarter, we have the European quarter. We have a Koto choir on the campus. You can play this, and they travel all over with Koto and give concerts. We also have an apostles choir. We have housing on the campus that if you want to be together with your own people, it's the Black House, the Spanish House. You don't live there, but you can get together so you feel you're with people who are like you, and you don't feel so alone. Just before I left, I mean, you get choices. You can go to South America, you can go to Europe, you can go to Asia, and the one to China is so crowded that the college professors from all over wanted to come. How come you're so involved with China? They want to learn what we did to get accepted to come there and study. Consequently, we have students that go over there as teachers or resupply, and we bring teachers from their countries back on our campus. I mean, the exposure and the values that they're getting, I think, with this humanism, accepting all people, is just something I'm so proud of. And just before I left, a teacher was standing by me, and she said, I'm supposed to go to South Africa this summer and find out about children's literature. You know, she's involved in teaching children. So I want to know, I'm going to know what those children learned as children. Come back here. And I do that in my courses. And definitely they'll be taking groups over there in South Africa as well. I mean, we already have some in South Africa, but this is a special gift.
Well, I don't want to hold you before the bell rings for lunch, because some people rush to get
to the first
lunch. But the one thing that I think this video struck me as I've listened to it and heard, have seen it a couple times, is the power of whiteness. And how each of the groups talk about the power of whiteness. And we didn't get to see the white group talk about what that was for them. But it wasn't about the power of who I am. No. It's the power of who I'm not. Yeah. And what that means in this society. And I think you spoke to that in terms of your husband. And the experience is that what he experiences is the loss of who he is, but you get the privilege of carrying that bag and never getting stopped. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to, we started this kind of talking about a couple days ago about the notion of whiteness, and we didn't get a chance to talk about that much. And yesterday we ended before we got into the video, sort of talking about the power of racism is to shape our identity in such a way that it tells us who we are. Mm-hmm. And what this says to these women of color is that you're nobody if you're not white. I'll let you say the final comment.
Yeah,
we'll
okay.
Let you go for that.
There's been two incidents when I've been older that I noticed something. One time we were visiting San Francisco and we went to some soda parlor. And the soda parlor would hold maybe 150 people. It was near a park, not far from San Francis Drake Hotel. And you went in there for a sundae or something. And we were sitting in there and they had mirrors all around and stuff. And we were waiting and waiting. And we happened to look in some of the mirrors. And I says, there's something different in here to my wife. And so, I don't know, I feel the same way, you know. And it turned out that in this place, with all these people, we're the only two people in the whole place that have blue eyes. We never noticed that before. We've never been into a place like that. And at a different time, we went to Spain, and we're in Madrid. And we go off on the subway or something, go into town, and that's a pretty good-sized city. And we would see all day long, going to shops and so forth, we'd see just a couple of people with blue eyes. But anyway, I thought that was
you were the minority.
Yeah. We were definite. We're a definite minority.
I've been in that position too.
And
I'm in that position right now.
Huh?
I'm in that position right now.
Yeah.
All my life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just a vacation.
Isn't your video available?
It is, well, it's not available here, but it's called The Way Home. You can get it through California Newsreel, which is a not-for-profit sort of distribution group
is that
in California.
Yes, but yeah.
All available, it's are a, you to come on campus to talk? All available, are you?
You just call me.
Well, I think that's...
And I'll come visit you anytime.
Well, that would be another way to bring you into the community on the college campus.
Yes.
Invite the churches.
And then, yeah, and there's a tremendous amount of work happening on college campuses. And actually, this is very, very popular on college campuses. They use it a lot. So, and it's on for those of you that I passed out the form for.
Do you have a form?
Here. See if I have another one.
Thank you.
Very good.
Excellent.
Yes.